This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome back. I'm Peter Terzakian. This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. It's April 4th, 2019.
And I'm Jackie Forrest. Well, today we have a guest to our podcast. We want to welcome Ian Anderson, President and CEO of Trans Mountain Corporation.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good. Well, today is an opportunity to learn more about this important project. I know many of our listeners probably know a bit about it already. It's an existing 300,000 barrel a day pipeline wanting to expand to 890,000 barrels a day, connecting Alberta oil with our Canadian West Coast for shipment to Asia and the U.S. West Coast. So today we're going to talk about the history of the pipeline, the expansion project. We're going to clarify some facts from fiction on the project. There's definitely a lot of questions around the environmental impacts, and we want to make sure that we get the facts right, as well as the next steps. So yeah. Maybe we'll start with history, Peter.
Yeah, let's do the history. I've got this book here, actually. I've got in my collection one of the original corporate Trans Mountain books on the original construction. It was constructed in 1953, in operation for 65 years. And there's been some changes along the way. Isn't that right, Ian?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Peter. And I've got the same book, and I look at it frequently and hope to write another one. The original pipeline was commissioned after an act of parliament, actually, in 1951, designed to move ever-increasing Western Sedimentary Basin production to really west coast of North America markets, whether that was British Columbia or California. So 1951 act of parliament was completed in 1953 at a capital cost of about $93 million.
Well,
came into service in October of 1953.
Which is quite remarkable because it went over, I don't know, two mountain ranges at least. And even in 1953, that was a real engineering feat, but there was an expansion. When, about a decade ago?
We completed really the first phase of this major expansion in 2007-2008 when we completed the twinning of the pipeline through Jasper National Park and Mount Robson Provincial Park. At that point, we went from 225,000 barrels a day up to the current 300,000 barrels a day. And in our mind, it was the first step towards a staged expansion of the asset to the West Coast as shippers and producers are looking for more access.
So let's just, before we move on, give a little context in terms of size. I always like to do that. So 300,000 barrels a day. And what is the Trans Mountain, the proposal to take it up to?
If we complete the twinning, if everything's approved and when we get it in service, we'll go from 300 up to 890. We'll have two lines between Edmonton and the West Coast.
Right.
We'll continue to serve the Washington State refinery market. That's one of our major pulls. About almost a half of the current capacity of the line goes into Washington State, so we'll continue to serve that market. And we'll have more capacity to move barrels offshore to foreign markets, including California. And to continue to reliably serve, and this is an important point, the British Columbia interior and lower mainland gasoline and diesel market and the Parkland refinery in Vancouver. So all of it provides more capacity to serve all those markets.
And so to finish off the historical note, of course, there was a major historical milestone last year with the acquisition of the pipeline by the federal government.
Yeah, we went through, we've been working on this project since really 2008. We went to the market in 2010, 2011. And under Kinder Morgan ownership, I had the full backing of my owner and board to proceed with the project as we had envisioned it. What we encountered through the period of really 2016-17 were repeated, consistent obstacles that were presented to us, be they regulatory, legal, or political for that matter, that had Kinder Morgan look for another party who would who'd be patient enough and determined enough to get it built, and it resulted in the transaction of last August.
So the federal government is now the owner of this, in many ways, like a vital piece of infrastructure. As you say, it serves the energy needs of British Columbia. And, there's a lot of nervousness, or actually, I don't even know what the word is, all the range of emotions from anxiety to frustration to outright anger in some constituencies of Canada that the federal government would buy the pipeline. But I argue that, most of the energy infrastructure in this country is already publicly owned. Our electrical utilities and transmission lines, and Ontario Hydro, Quebec Hydro, Manitoba Hydro, it goes on and on. So why is all the consternation out there for public ownership of a piece of energy infrastructure?
Yeah, I think the history has been in Alberta that the pipeline sector has been invested in and built by investor capital. If you even go back to the early days of the 50s and 60s, when producers were the ones really backing the construction of the pipeline infrastructure, that's been our history. But, you know, in the evolution of any asset that's of national importance, that I believe this one is, going back to 1951, there are times and places where public ownership perhaps is a necessary element to their success. Mm-hmm. And this project and this asset reached a point in time where it was in all of our interests, I believe, as Canadians, to put the capital behind it that had the right determination and patience to see it through. And it's not going to be held by Crown Corporation or by Canada forever. And they've been very clear about that. It'll be turned back to public hands. And my objective is to run it commercially, whether it's a crown or not a crown. It's got to be run commercially and viably. And at the end of the day, deliver Canadians a return on the investment that they made.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's talk about where the current project is. Well, so 10 years now, if you started in 2008, a long time in the making. But the current step in the process has been to deal with Federal Court of Appeal in August 2018 that said you had to go back and do some work. One was the marine shipping issues, which were recently addressed in a reconsideration report that made 16 new conditions. That was released in February of this year. And then First Nations consultation by the federal government needs to occur. Now, Minister Sohi, our natural resources minister, said in March that the federal government had met with over 100 different Indigenous communities and said that this process should wrap up and that potentially they could be in the position to approve the project by cabinet in the summer. So the first question I have is around this Indigenous consultation. I think a lot of Canadians wonder, like, wasn't this done already by your company? And what's different about what the federal government's doing today versus what's already been done?
The scope of the Federal Court of Appeal decision in August of last year as it relates to the Indigenous consultation was actually quite narrow and specific. And what it was instructing the government to do is go back and redo that consultation that had occurred between the time of NEB recommendation and order and council decision by government. That period back in 2016 was a 7-month period where there was an obligation on the Crown to go back to the nations to review really the outcome of the NEB decision. Did it address their concerns? Did they have any remaining issues? Was there any further accommodation necessary in order to satisfy their concerns? And that was the element of consultation was found to be deficient. There was no criticism of the work we have done as proponent for the last 6 or 8 years in consulting and engaging and meeting with communities. There was no criticism of the National Energy Board process. It was really quite a specific period of time that was put in question. And that's what the government is going back and, if you like, redoing.
So there was 156 conditions of the original approval. And so basically it was to go back and talk to the First Nations and other Indigenous groups around their views of those changes and were they accommodating their
concerns.
Yeah,
it was to go back to the nations to review the outcome of the NEB decision and the related conditions. And did those conditions accommodate, mitigate, and respond to their issues and concerns and do that at a local nation-by-nation basis? And so that's why the minister will refer to over 100 mm-hmm. communities have been met with. I think we have 126 on the list right now. The benefit we have right now, and this goes back to your question, Peter, about Crown ownership, is we are now part of the Crown. We are now a Crown corporation. We are at those tables with the Crown every meeting to discuss the impacts of the mm-hmm. projects and the things that perhaps we could do differently to design, build, and execute on a project that is more in touch with what a nation's concerns are. So we have a much more powerful table, if you mm-hmm. like, in addressing those concerns than we had before.
Can you identify for our listeners, like, where geographically, or I should maybe probably use the word territorially, the greatest Indigenous resistance is to the pipeline?
We've got 43 explicit supporting communities, and we've probably got another 15 or 20 that we're working with. And for most of them, it's not a matter of opposition to the project. It's a matter of ensuring that their local concerns are being protected. For example, have we got a rigorous enough marine response to anything that may happen on water? Have we considered groundwater and aquifer and stream and river protection as we go through the North Thompson? Have we enabled those communities with opportunities to work on the project and to work for me and to gain employment and capacity? Those are mostly the issues and concerns. Mm-hmm. It isn't outright opposition. You certainly definitely have pockets of opposition, and I would say they're centered in some parts of the Lower Mainland, obviously, and the marine communities around Burrard Inlet have been the most vocal opponents, whether that's Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, for example. You've got a few in the interior around the Coldwater region, south of Merritt, who have stood in opposition. But I'm continuing to talk with their community and the chief, and hopefully we can resolve our differences. So it's a bit scattered along the line, but we're working hard on all of
nice.
It.
So the other piece of the peel was the marine issues. And as I said, there was this report in February with 16 new conditions. Can you speak specifically to the recommendations that were made about the orca in the region that have been declining in their population? And I guess when I looked at that recommendations, I wondered how a pipeline company can control like marine traffic generally in that large area.
Well, I mean, very, very quickly, when we started out on this project, one of the things we decided and learned very quickly is that we needed to look at the entire supply chain, not just stopping at the dock where our asset ends. We knew that to be successful, we had to think about and deal with marine traffic, given the sensitivity in the area. So we have been partners with, whether it's the Marine Response Corporation or the pilots or the port or the Chamber of Shipping, for a decade now to ensure that all of those pieces of the chain are working well. As it relates to the specific reconsideration, there were 16 recommendations that the NEB made to other regulators. So think about Transport Canada or DFO or the Coast Guard. The NEB doesn't have jurisdiction over those spaces, but they made the 16 recommendations on things that those agencies could do differently to help address the concerns as expressed by the Federal Court of Appeal specific to species at risk and the orcas, the southern resident killer whales population on the South Salish Sea. Some of those recommendations, I won't go into all 16 of them, but they deal with the speed of ship traffic and not just tankers. This is an important thing. This was about our effect on those species or the increased tanker traffic. But the benefits, or if the recommendations are pursued, they will benefit all traffic. And we are but, 8 or 10% of traffic. So there will be incremental benefits to the whole value chain of marine traffic in the Salish Sea. And they relate to things like the speed of ships.
So what you're saying is that, it affects all the way from cruise ships to freighters.
Ferries to whale-watching boats to all commercial traffic are going to have new requirements that are going to make the sea safer around ship noise, around tug escort capacity for tankers specifically, underwater monitoring for the behavior of the orcas, Chinook salmon habitat restoration.
So ironically, what you're saying is, it brings up another important point. This whole pipeline debate has created a situation where the seas are actually more environmentally friendly, I'll call it, and safer.
There will no doubt be measures taken that will make the transit and the understanding of the marine environment better than it was before.
Right. And that's one of the arguments that the oil industry would put forth, isn't it, Jackie, that the construction of the pipeline and the addition of some tankers into the mix actually creates an environment where there is more spill response capacity. That, in fact, if there was a spill, say, from Washington State out of our jurisdiction, but close by, or say further up north, if Kitimat, Prince Rupert, if we get tankers there, that it makes it much safer. What do you say to that?
For the south coast of BC and for the Southern Salish Sea, there is no doubt in my mind that the measures being taken will explicitly improve response capability. We're investing $150 million on 7 new bases within that area that are going to reduce response time to any incident, not just a tanker incident. It could be any incident. So response time is going down, capability and capacity is going up. First Nations are being involved directly in the training and the deployment of that equipment and those bases. And we have designs to put some of those basins right in First Nation marine communities so that their people will operate, be trained on. And like I said, it's not just about tankers at that point. It's about any traffic that's in distress or relies upon some response capability.
Yeah, so I think that's an important point in reading the report, which I actually tried to get through a lot of it. I would encourage our listeners to do that. You know, there's going to be more spill response equipment. There's going to be more bases. So all things the same, if there were a spill, we should be able to respond faster than we could today. So from that perspective, things are better.
In fact, the regulated response times by NEB and Transport Canada directives will reduce down to 2 hours or less. So there will be regulated response times that the capacity needs to match. So it won't just be, we hope it's reduced, it will be reduced.
Okay, and another aspect that gets talked about is that there will be more tankers. So for instance, the NEB says that about 5 tankers are loaded per month today in Burnaby, and that the new project, they would expect about 34 per month. And you had talked about that would then be about 8 to 10% of all the ship traffic, or is it just tanker traffic at that point?
We currently today are about 6 or 7%. It will go up to 12 or 14% of overall traffic.
Is that assuming that the overall traffic is growing too?
Yes, we know that. Yeah, right? The total traffic of container ships and cargo vessels are increasing as well.
Mm-hmm. So all things the same, though, we are increasing the number of tankers that are on the ocean, and all things the same, you would think that the oil spill risk would go up as there's more tankers. But are there things that are changing to help reduce the chances of a spill and offset the effect of just having more tankers?
Yeah, I mean, we've done extensive risk calculations around does the risk go up or not. And when we look at the mitigative measures that we'll put in place, we don't think the risk goes up. We think that the measures such as increased tug escorts with every tanker, the speed of the tankers, the measures we're putting in place for navigation, the companion length of tugs with the tankers all the way out to the Strait of Juan de Fuca and beyond Victoria, the tugs will be escorting tankers. So there are elements that are going to reduce that risk, even though the tanker traffic does go up. I would remind your listeners of one thing, and that is that we have the capacity today to move generally 5 tankers a month. We will have the capacity in the future to move up to 34 a month. The market will decide whether they're going to move barrels off the water or into Washington State or some other place. So it really is a design. It's not I don't have contracts in hand to move 34 tankers a month. I've got contracts to move barrels down my pipeline, but those could go to different places, not necessarily over water. So the market will decide how many ships move. And the last point I'd make is the 34 is a hard number. In other words, we can only move loaded ships from Port of Vancouver during daylight high slack tide times. So we can't move ships in and out whenever they want to come in. There is only one high slack tide per 20-hour, 22-hour period. So we're limited by how many ships we can move, and that gets you to the 34.
Well, what is the slack tide?
The vessels can come in under any tide. Mm-hmm. The vessels go out during slack tide, which is the time between when the high tide is at its highest before the low tide has started. So the waters are still and calm, and they're not, flooding in or flooding out.
You're not getting the rip tide effect.
You're not getting the movement of the tides in and out.
The current.
That slack tide where it's right between the periods.
Okay.
I want to clarify a couple of those mitigating activities that are happening. So when tankers do have oil spills, a lot of times it's a result of losing the engine power. So having tugs around the tanker guiding it out really does statistically reduce the chances of an oil spill. Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, firstly, all of these tankers are double-hulled. They're segmented. They have 2 BC pilots trained and experienced on BC waters on every vessel. Who are managing those vessels in and out. We don't have foreign pilots on these vessels when they're in BC waters. So yeah, you're absolutely right that those tugs are not just accompanying the vessel, they're actually hard tethered to the vessel. And we run deployment exercises regularly that experience a rudder failure and have the tug take over control of the vessel through some of the narrowest points of the inlet. So we go through testing to make sure those tugs and those operators are there to take over really movement of the vessel in the event of a rudder loss.
So what do they do in Washington State? Just immediately south? Like, do they have this level of stringency?
They don't have this level of tug support. They don't have this level of tethered tugs. They don't have this level of tug exports. Now, they're not navigating through Burrard Inlet. They are in more open waters as they go in and out of ports in Washington State. But having said that, we're going to have by far the most rigorous marine protection and response capability that you find worldwide.
And these local pilots are actually, in the new scenario, going to actually stay on the boat longer than they do today,
They are going to stay on the boat longer. Currently today, they go from our dock in Burnaby to around Race Rocks, which is just south of Victoria. And in the future, they will go all the way out to what's called J-Boy or Juliet Boy, out further out on the edges of Canadian waters.
Yeah. Speaking of Burnaby, when we talked about Indigenous resistance, and, you know, I've been to the facility there in Burnaby and looked at it, and it's in the middle of a residential neighborhood, basically. So can you talk a little bit about the resistance in Burnaby and what the challenges and what's going on there?
Well, first of all, we've been, you know, what we think to be an upstanding, you know, corporate community, you know, citizen of Burnaby for 60 years. And the community has evolved from what was an industrial center with four refiners down to what it is today, which is a more park-like residential, you know, city. So it's grown up around us differently than we were before. That said, we have a site that with all the infrastructure in place to expand upon that we can have meet all of the expectations around being that good corporate citizen, whether that's in involvement in the community, employment within the community, but also safety measures and fire protection measures. Burnaby has been generally, I would say, politically opposed. That has helped translate into what has been general public opposition. We do our polling, and we find that there is moderate support depending upon the poll and the time of year, but it still runs around that 55, 45, 53, 47 kind of number. But I think that
we're 54 or against?
Four.
Okay.
You know, but there still is a significant, you know, public opposition to Burnaby. What we are starting to achieve is, with the inevitability that we hope comes with decisions in the coming months, is really engaging more fully with Burnaby and their citizens around what might this look like and how might we execute on this project so they can be secure and safe in the asset being in their community.
So one of the concerns, I think, on the coast is that diluted bitumen behaves differently in ocean and freshwater than other types of oil, and potentially could sink faster, making it harder to respond to spills and making the environmental cleanup more difficult. Is this true?
Well, all the science that we've been a part of or that we have participated in or helped fund or read would suggest that diluted bitumen is a heavy oil. I mean, lots of people like to talk about diluted bitumen because it's got some connotation that there are two separate parts of it that somehow separate once they are exposed to the environment. It's heavy oil. And heavy oil floats on water, whether it's fresh water or it is salt water. And we've done extensive study around that. And there are different grades of commodity and there are different marine conditions that are continuing to be tested. The evidence to date would suggest that the oil floats. And the key to it is response time. So it goes back to what's our response time? How quickly can we gain access? Because there are circumstances, obviously, like with anything, that you get water movement, you get wave action, you get sediment in the water. Those are the things that would contribute to any commodity in the water sinking as those conditions separate it. And I think that it goes then back to a risk-based response plan, which we have in place, will be at any incident in less than 2 hours with capability of cleanup. So we think that with all of the technology we're bringing to the response side of it and the investments there, combined with the safe tug and the safe tanker operations, combined with the trained personnel. Now, we have committed to the NEB and the public at large that we will continue the research. We're going to continue the research into the fate and behavior of oil commodities in water, and we are obligated to continue to be a part of that research and adapt with that research as it continues. So research is continuing under different, as I said, marine conditions with different substances, and we'll be a part of that, and we'll respond accordingly.
You know, there's a lot of data in that report. Chapter 8 has some information around it, and there's been a lot of studies, and they're having, you know, large tanks that they expose to the elements and see how long the diluted bitumen will float. And it's finding, you know, the conclusion that I got out of it is it's, as you said, very similar to other heavy oils and not unique from Maya crudes or other heavy crudes that would be shipped on the ocean.
Exactly.
Or even bunker fuels that are in the tanks of many ships that are transiting the lower mainland.
Absolutely.
Like cruise ships.
Cruise ships or any ship. I mean, bunker fuel today, and I know it's changing maybe in the future as we move off bunker fuels, but today most ships are running with bunker fuel, which would be very similar in its properties. All right, let's talk about the next steps for the pipeline, Ian. So as I said earlier in March, Minister Sohi commented that Ottawa is in a strong position to wrap up the Indigenous consultation with the potential for Cabinet to approve the project by summer. If that were to occur, what do you think that would mean for the project's timeline and potential operating date?
Yeah, it's the $64,000 question. And if there's one thing I've learned on this journey for the last 6 or 8 years is it's almost impossible to predict the timing of things. Having said that, we know that the Crown is diligently undertaking these engagements, as Minister Sohi says. We're at those tables as well. There is volumes of information and data being undertaken. The 90-day or 3-month period after NEB recommendation, that's a legislative time period that the government has to issue an order or extend the time. So that comes due on May 22nd. So by May 22nd, there either needs to be a decision or another order in council to extend the period. And I don't know which way it's going to go. Only, you know, really the cabinet will make that decision in due course. We will be ready for a decision whenever it is made. We're developing our plans to be prepared to start construction in the summer, to get back in the ground and in the water, continuing our work at building our dock and working on it right away this summer. And we would have full crews on the ground this fall working on the right of way if a decision comes in May or June. If it's after that, then we'll adjust accordingly and we'll be patient and we'll be resilient and be prepared to go when the decision does finally get made. We're looking at the depending upon when we start, about a 30 to 36 month construction period for everything to get done. So you can handicap your dates on when a decision might come out, but you can then look at 30 to 36 months depending upon. And the reason I say a decision that comes at a certain date is going to be affected by marine windows, salmon spawning windows, bird migration windows, those things affect what we can actually
political
do
windows.
On the ground. Yeah. Political windows and elections. So all those things will affect
Suburb construction
actual
season, too.
Exactly. Yeah. So depending on when you get a decision, that's why I say 30, 36.
You know, we get these decisions and, you know, we've talked, Jackie and I, on the podcast previously about how the whole approval process for energy infrastructure is now fragmented in beyond the regulator into the judiciary, into the political system, not only the political system at one level, say provincial, but not federal. So, okay, Minister Sohi comes out in the next 90 days before June and says, okay, let's green light, let's go. There is a potential for other wild cards here, politically, judiciary, is there or no?
I have no doubt that there will be judicial reviews sought, that there will be appeals taken to either the regulator or to the Court of Appeal. And we will look at those when they arise. We will evaluate what we think the merits, you know, might be, what we think the success could be. And I would expect to proceed on the basis that we have an approved project at that stage.
Right.
And you know, absent an injunction that stops construction, those legal proceedings are going to, you know, be under, like they did before.
Right.
We started construction in the face of 9 Federal Court of Appeal actions before and, you know, resulted in the stop work order and going back to the drawing board on a couple measures. But we're prepared to continue in the face of that if, you know, we determine that those appeals are likely to remain in our favor.
I want to talk about one on that topic, one specific appeal, the reference case that the BC government has put towards the Court of Appeal to determine if BC can control the movement of hazardous materials through their province, which they define diluted bitumen to be one of those, and basically control the fact that they can allow oil, but not a particular type of oil. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us where that's at and the potential that has to slow down the project?
Yeah, I don't know that there's a direct relationship between it and the project. But if the BC government was successful in their reference case, it would give them the authority to control the movement of hazardous substances to the provinces, which could be diluted bitumen. And it's through any transportation mode, truck, train, pipeline. So it's not unique to us, but certainly it would be applicable to us if they chose to. That case has been heard. It concluded a couple of weeks ago before the BC Court of Appeal. And we're now waiting for a decision. And our view is that decision is 2 to 4 months from the end of March. So it's probably the summer, fall as well. We'll have more clarity on that. It doesn't necessarily in and of itself mean anything unless, A, it is upheld and that there's nobody successful on appeal on quashing it, and also that it is actually, you know, put into regulation and that something comes about from it that would hinder us. But, you know, as a pipeline operator, I move all kinds of different commodities. I move gasoline, diesel, light oil, heavy oil, and I'll continue to move whatever my producers and shippers put in the pipeline and commit to us. So it really becomes more of a producer issue than it does a pipeline issue. I can still have the expansion proceed, and then it becomes what can producers put in it. Mm-hmm. And so that will require a lot of hard thought by the producing community if it was ever successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been really generous with your time, Ian. Thanks for coming. And one final thing, let's go full circle. We talked at the outset about the federal government buying the pipeline. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about when it may have an intent to sell. And I know mm-hmm. that there's some noise in the media right now about potential sale to Indigenous groups and so on. Can you comment on any of that?
The only thing I would say is Canada has been very clear that this is not a long hold. My mission is to generate value for Canadians in a subsequent sale of this asset, make it worth something that's greater than what Canada paid for it, has been my sole purpose for the next several years. As far as the ownership makeup going forward, I think there has been a number, I count them, of probably 4 or 5 different Indigenous groups that have raised their hand to be interested in some ownership. And Minister Morneau has been pretty clear that he will consider a process to determine who those parties might be, how they might get involved, and when they might get involved. I think that they want to go about that in a commercially minded way as well. But certainly it provides a vehicle through which Canada can continue to execute on its reconciliation plan. I mean, reconciliation doesn't happen as a single event. It's a bunch of little things that add up. And this is one where I think that opportunity will be presented. Whether or not commercially, you know, we can find the right terms and the right counterparty, we'll see. But I certainly think it's part of the fabric of us going forward.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. Well, Ian, thank you very much for joining our podcast and the hard work that you and your team are doing to keep pressing forward since 2008 on this very, very important project for the Canadian energy industry.
Jackie, Peter, thanks very much for the opportunity.
Great. Thanks for coming in. It's been great talking with you.
If you like this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever app you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.